on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu.
It's 2:40 Central Time, and in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine tomorrow, we'll continue with the State of the State address in terms of analysis. We'll have three guests joining us tomorrow afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour: former State Representative Rick Winkle, State House observers Charlie Wheelhouse and Mike Lawrence. That's all tomorrow during the afternoon magazine. In sports, news from the Chicago Cubs organization: pitching great Greg Maddux has rejoined the Cubs as an assistant to general manager Jim Hendry. He'll help develop players. Another former Cub Hall of Famer, Ryne Sandberg, has been introduced as the new skipper of AAA Iowa. He says it's a step toward his goal of managing in the majors. Baseball fans in the St. Louis area say they're willing to move on and forgive Mark McGwire, who yesterday admitted he used steroids over several seasons. That includes his then record-breaking 1998 season as a Cardinal when he hit 70 homers. Illinois puts its 3-0 Big Ten basketball record on the line tonight against Penn State, and the Illini cannot afford to look past the 0-3 Nittany Lions. Penn State has won its last three games in Champaign. The St. Louis Blues hope a game against the Columbus Blue Jackets tonight can boost their fortunes on home ice. The Blues have dropped five straight at Scott Trade Center in St. Louis and are 6-14-3 overall. The Blue Jackets have won three in a row. And Fox is announcing today it is launching its second all-soccer network in the United States on March 1st. The new network will be called Fox Soccer Plus and will televise matches of the European Champions League, England's Premier League, the English Football Association Cup, and the Italian Serie A. Fox Soccer Channel began operation in 1997 and changed its name to FSC 5 years ago. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Esquire Lounge, corner of Walnut and University in historic downtown Champaign. The Esquire Lounge provides an informal atmosphere for drinking and dining with high-definition TV for watching the Illini and other sports events.
It's 2:42. Starting today, $5,000 will buy you a piece of Arizona's government. We're not talking about access to lawmakers here. We're talking about the buildings they meet in. More than two dozen state buildings are for sale, and that includes the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. NPR's Ted Robbins explains.
It's a bit unusual to sell a state capitol, state hospital, prisons, and park visitor centers. But when you have $1.5 billion deficit to make up between now and July, Arizona Department of Administration spokesman Alan Ecker says you do unusual things.
The proceeds will be going straight into the Arizona State General Fund to offset the budget crisis that we're dealing with.
The total, $735 million. Arizona would then lease back the buildings over 20 years. Investors would buy $5,000 certificates of participation and get an estimated 4-5% interest a year. The question is, how safe is an investment in the state of Arizona? Its credit rating was downgraded just last month because of its budget crisis. But Alan Ecker says in this case, we're talking about buildings which have to operate if Arizona remains a state.
So the state would be very, very unlikely to ever default on payments and walk away from those facilities. So investors should have a strong peace of mind.
Arizona is quickly running out of money, so it hopes to sell the certificates and close the deal by the end of the month. Ted Robbins, NPR News, Tucson.
The city of Tokyo isn't running out of money, but it's running out of patience. For 8 years, it's been waging war against its crows. The campaign reportedly began after a crow buzzed Tokyo's governor as he played golf, prompting a declaration that he would turn crow meat pies into Tokyo's favorite dish. Well, that hasn't happened, but the battle continues today with mixed results, as NPR's Lisa Lim found out on a trip to Tokyo.
This is the sound that makes Yumiko Kono's heartbeat faster as she pounds around Yoyogi Park in central Tokyo. She's a long-distance runner who covers at least 7 miles a day. She's highly sensitive to sound since she's blind. She runs with the aid of a companion. A year and a half ago, she was attacked by a crow in the park, an experience that has traumatized her.
A crow landed on my head just for an instant while I was running. It was like it was using my head as a jumping board. I was surprised, then scared. Now when I hear crows cawing and their wings flapping, I still get scared.
She's not alone. Many Tokyo dwellers have been dive-bombed by the big black jungle crows that flap around the city. Everyone knows someone who's been pecked or pooped upon. For Alfred Hitchcock fans, it's eerily reminiscent of his thriller, The Birds.
I mean, birds just don't go around attacking people without no reason, you know what I mean? Kids probably scared them, that's all.
These birds attacked.
In that movie, flocks of birds victimized one small town, with hundreds of crows attacking the local schoolchildren. In Tokyo, it's not that bad yet, but the big black bullies do cause technological havoc. They nest in utility poles and cause blackouts. They even steal fiber-optic cables to build nests, sometimes disabling parts of the broadband network. Tokyo's crow tsar, Toshimasa Uno, admits crow numbers are on the up. He blames commuter crows, who fly in to feast on the capital's garbage.
The crow number increased by 16% from the year before. We think the reason is that crows fly into Tokyo from the suburbs.
He says the corvine population now stands, or flies, at an estimated 21,200. That's despite millions of dollars spent on the war on crows.
The crow budget for 2009 was about $700,000. The year before, it worked out to around $50 for every crow killed. But we have to spend this money because people are complaining.
We're here with park manager Koji Takagi, and we're picking our way amongst the greenery, and we're going to see the crow traps the government's been using to try to battle the crows.
Most of the crows we catch with this trap are young ones that are inexperienced. But it's good to catch the young ones so they can't breed and increase the number of crows.
Back in Yoyogi Park, birds are thrashing around inside the traps, which are enormous cages 10 by 20 feet, open in the middle. The crows are lured in by lard smeared on the ground. Once in, hanging spikes stop them from flying out. Park manager Takagi says every 3 days, the trapped crows are taken away to be gassed.
We do get complaints from people opposed to the crow extermination, but this is the policy of the Environment Bureau. People should also learn to deal with garbage better.
So we're now going to see a very unusual project here in central Tokyo, in the swanky shopping district of Ginza. That buzzing noise that you can probably hear is 300,000 honeybees that are being kept in beehives right in the center of Tokyo. And Atsuo Tanaka, the co-founder of the Ginza Honeybee Project, says this project is actually helping keep the crows away.
The bees become very aggressive when they see shiny black objects because it reminds them of bears or hornets that might attack them. So whenever they see crows, a whole swarm of bees will chase them.
And although the honeybees chase away the black marauders, they're surprisingly friendly to humans.
You tried?
You want me to touch those honeybees?
Yes, yes.
Will they bite me?
Yes, okay. No.
Okay, I'm very nervous. Soft. I'm actually touching the back of the honeybees. They are. It's really soft.
This may be an eco-friendly solution, and one which provides honey into the bargain. But so far, it's unproven and impractical on a larger scale. The battle of birds and bees seems almost surprising in the setting of Tokyo's high-tech urban jungle. But the war on crows underlines that finding the right balance between man and nature isn't easy, even in a city. Louisa Lim, NPR News.
You might think you know corn, as in corn tortillas, corn flakes, corn bread, and so on. But do you really know corn? Did you know that the last harvest could be one of our biggest, or that most American corn is genetically modified? Sean Ali reports experts want us to get reacquainted with our biggest crop because we need to make huge decisions about its future.
Virginia Walbut researches corn genetics at Stanford University, and recently she got news that didn't just make her day, it kind of made her decade. Walbut says scientists just finished sequencing genes of an important corn genome.
The genes are like the words in different languages, and what you need is a dictionary that lists all those words. And that dictionary for us is the genome sequence.
Walbut says this research could allow us to breed new corn varieties faster than ever before. And that's a big deal because even though we benefit from corn we have now, we could make it better. For example, corn creates environmental problems. Just take corn fertilizer.
Of course, adding fertilizer really boosts yield, but the downstream effects are not always great. So there's runoff from farms that contaminates the water supply. Making corn as efficient as possible and using fertilizer, basically just giving enough fertilizer to sustain yield, those would be fantastic goals.
Now, most corn researchers want to meet these kinds of environmental goals, but there's a question science alone can't answer, and that is, what kinds of corn should we grow or improve? Kinds of corn? Well, maybe you're thinking corn chips versus popcorn, but there are bigger differences. We actually eat sweet corn, but most corn is starchy, industrial stuff.
I think that's one thing consumers get confused about is today only 1% of corn production goes into sweet corn.
That's Pam Johnson. She's with the National Corn Growers Association. Johnson says about half our corn goes to animal feed. Then we eat the meat or dairy products from that. But a lot goes to industrial products, too. Take ethanol. Ethanol uses more than a third of the corn in the American corn market. Johnson says corn farmers want scientists to create specialty industrial corn that can fetch premium prices, like corn just for ethanol or corn just for renewable corn-based plastic.
You know, we've always said for a long time that anything that's made out of petroleum can be made from a renewable, and I think that's an exciting thing to ponder as a corn grower.
Johnson predicts new genetic science will also improve the corn we eat directly. But is that likely to happen?
I have my doubts.
That's Rainer Bussmann. He's with the Missouri Botanical Garden, and he studies how people use plants.
Feeding people is less, say, an economic incentive than producing large amounts of corn, say, for animal feed or for biofuels. So I do have my doubts there.
Bussmann says it's a shame that food varieties of corn will get less attention from genetic research. He says he worries about food security. He figures if we grow more types of food corn, we'll be better protected from crop diseases. But it's also a matter of taste, though. Bussmann has traveled the world, and he's tasted corn we don't grow here, like this blue kind in South America.
They would call that maíz morada, which basically means purple corn, and that is mostly used to produce a very refreshing, sweet beverage. So you get this deeply purple, sugary drink, and it's all natural. It's no sugar added.
Bussmann says Native Americans and the earliest settlers produce hundreds of varieties of corn for all kinds of food dishes. Corn for just pudding, just bread, just porridge, and so on. They created this food diversity without modern genetic science. But we do have it. Bussmann asks, why should our science just improve animal feed, ethanol, and bioplastics? Why not make food our priority, too? For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
In 1998, NPR's special correspondent Susan Stamberg visited a woman in Amsterdam and asked her this question.
How do you say diary in Dutch?
Dagboek.
Dagboek? Or like day book?
Yeah.
Dagboek.
Book
is diary.
That woman is Miep Kees. The diary she is referring to is Anne Frank's. Miep Kees helped Anne Frank hide with her family during World War II and saved Anne's diary after the Frank family was captured by the Germans. Kees died yesterday. She was 100 years old. Terry Schultz has this remembrance.
Miep Kees said she did not like being called a hero. Yet she risked her life many times over to help the Frank family during the 2 years they hid from the Nazis in a secret annex built into the trading company office in Amsterdam, where she'd worked for Otto Frank almost a decade. Providing refuge to Jews, she noted later, carried a punishment of at least 6 months in a concentration camp. Still, the Austrian-born Dutchwoman, knighted by the governments of Germany and the Netherlands, recipient of a medal from Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum, always insisted she had done nothing extraordinary.
I myself, I'm just a very common person. I simply had no choice. I could foresee many, many sleepless nights, and a life filled with regret if I would refuse to help the Franks. And this was not the kind of life I was looking forward to.
Geese explained another motivation for emphasizing her modesty. She said if people are allowed to think it takes remarkable qualities to act boldly on behalf of others, few will attempt it.
People should never think that you have to be a very special person to help those who need you.
But Geese clearly was very special. Even when someone still unknown betrayed those she called the hiders and they were taken away at gunpoint to death camps, Geese was not intimidated. She sneaked back into the secret hideaway to try to preserve any belongings of the Franks that hadn't been destroyed or taken. And there she found what would eventually become a treasure of the entire world.
I saw Anne's diary scattered all over the floor. I took it with me. I hoped I could return into Anne after the war. I wanted to see her smile and hear her say, "Oh, meep, my diary."
That day would never come, as Anne did not survive the Nazi death camps. But Otto Frank did, and he made his way back to Amsterdam in 1945, returning to stay with Geese and her husband. On the very sad day that year that he learned both his daughters had died in a camp, Otto Frank later explained in a documentary, Geese delivered him what he called a miracle.
When I returned, and after I had the news that my children would not come back, Miep gave me the diary.
Geese described that moment herself years ago in an interview with the Anne Frank Museum in Amsterdam.
Heb al de dagboeken genomen met bladen en alles erbij.
Geese said she took the diary out of the desk where she'd saved it, and she handed it to Otto Frank with the words, "This is the legacy of your daughter Anne." She had never read a word of it and, in fact, could not bring herself to do so until after Otto Frank published the diary in 1947, 2 years after Anne's death. The Diary of Anne Frank is a legacy Miep Geese gave not just to Otto Frank, but to the world. It's been translated into some 65 languages and remains one of the best-read books internationally. To the end of her century of life, Geese said she thought with sadness every day about the friends she had lost. On her website, she wrote it was her greatest sorrow that she and the others had been unable to save Anne, but she was pleased they'd been able to give the young woman 2 more years of life. And in that period, Geese noted, Anne had written the diary with her message of tolerance and understanding. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Provena Covenant Medical Center, now an in-network provider for all Health Alliance plans, including HMO, PPO, point of service, and